Hello and welcome to this podcast from the Bristol Festival of Ideas. My name is George Miller, and at this May's festival, I was fortunate enough to get the chance to interview several of the guest speakers. On the 22nd of May, distinguished philosopher Mary Warnock discussed her new book, Dishonest to God, on keeping religion out of politics, with Julian Baggini. After the event, I spoke to her and began by remarking that one of the things which had come out of the session was the extent to which religion is embedded in our culture, education and language. But she wasn't, I suggested, arguing for a complete disentanglement of religion from other aspects of our lives.
So archaic because it's meant to be easier to understand. So that seems to me to lose a far point of the heritage of religion. And I certainly wouldn't want to see that destroyed or the cathedrals torn down or any such thing. Because I still think that religion, Christianity, is something that's not only embedded, but is deeply appealing for a lot of people. And I don't think the least want to disturb the faith of those people who don't find my objections to the literalness of Christianity compelling. But I do think that people make the mistake of thinking there's only one kind of truth, and that's the literal truth. So I would be terribly sad to see the language and the buildings and the music of religion tampered with. And I think actually a good deal of tampering has gone on already, too much.
You spoke specifically about faith schools and again the difficulty of dismantling something, even if it may not be something that you would design from scratch. Again, to go from where we are to the ideal maybe a challenge.
I think it's just very difficult. I certainly would feel awful if somebody really argued for abolishing all Church of England schools or indeed all Roman Catholic schools, because dogmatically Roman Catholicism is, in some ways, in my experience, Roman Catholic schools are not indoctrinating children, and children are quite able to stand up to indoctrination nowadays, even if they have it. But no, I think the Christian schools have done the most amazing things, and still do. And parents like them, and everybody likes them. But I do find it very difficult for any fundamentalist religion, whether Christian or Muslim, to be allowed to set up a school which is deliberately aimed at causing people to believe one thing and hate every other belief. I think that is immoral.
Of course, that then raises the issue of policing, as it were, exactly what the aims and intentions of a faith school is, and you know, making sure it's doing things which are not inciting hatred.
I think the whole relation between the Department of Education and the church schools is very good, a very subtle relation, but it's very good, and the main good is that the inspectorate would be extremely critical if there was too much indoctrination in the state schools. But I think it is, I really think it's necessary now to warn and train the inspectorate to keep a very, very sharp eye on schools where there is indoctrination, whether there's a fundamentalist Christian or a fundamentalist American Christian, or fundamentalist Muslim, or Jewish, for that matter. But on the whole, I think the Jews are extremely good at not indoctrinating.
You quote, I think it's Jonathan Sacks, isn't it, later on in the book, talking about practicing the faith in the minor key, or I get the impression it's something you're sympathetic to, a faith which is not expressed in a hostile or...
No, there's another remark that practicing faith in a minor key, and that was sort of the chief rabbi who made a speech in the House of Lords. It was one of the most moving things I ever heard, because he didn't talk about current politics or anything. He simply said how wonderful it was to be in the House of Lords and how much he owed this country because his parents were refugees in the 1930s and how deeply British he felt. And it was somehow incredibly moving. And this, I think, is rather typical of English Jews, that they practice their religion, but they don't try to impose it on anybody else.
No. All that said, you do say towards the end of the book that we must fend off the forces of theocracy, and that's quite strong language. So you clearly see that what's at stake is something really rather important.
Yes, it sounds very arrogant, but yes, I do think that.
And you see that when you spend a lot of time in the book talking about how legislation comes into being, legislation which deals with moral issues. And you clearly see that as an area where we have to be vigilant, or we have to not accord religion special moral status. So you do see that. Do you see that as a direction?
I think that's exactly right. I think, of course, people can come at moral issues from a religious point of view. But I think that ideally they would say, this is what my religion teaches, and then put the moral point of view, and they can then say, and I believe in this, but they mustn't expect special favours because they do come from a religious angle. I mean, I think one of the things that I find deeply irritating is when people talk about things like people of faith, as if having faith in some religion were a virtue in itself. It isn't. It's a way of thinking that not everybody adopts, and it's not a virtue.
Isn't the problem, though, for those people who do have religious beliefs, that it's sort of written into the constitution of their beliefs, that they can't easily say, well, this is what my religion teaches, without being able to say that they then therefore believe it is true, because it's been revealed.
Of course, that's true. I mean, it is terribly difficult for people who have strong religious beliefs not to try to convert other people, because what they believe in, what they say, is that this is true. And if something's true, then surely we all ought to believe it. But what I think they haven't grasped, and I think, as I said, the Jews are quite good at grasping, is that it is a revelation of truth for them. Truth that they sincerely believe in, rather, but they can't try to convert other people to that belief. Of course, it's easier for Judaism, because it always was the chosen people who believed this and not all the heathen outside. Whereas Christianity, it was meant to be a world religion for everybody, the kingdom of God was going to come where everybody believed the same thing. I think we simply have to take that as part of the mythology of Christianity. What it can be taken as symbolizing is that human beings are all in the same boat. We're fragile, we're tempted, we're likely to be terribly selfish if we get curbed. We're all the same in that respect, and that's where morality comes from. But we don't all have to believe in the same God.
You also talked about the power of narrative, the power of stories, for example, in the Bible, and that they can have a moral value and be morally instructive. But again, is there not a difficulty in sort of decoupling that from the aim, as it were, or in the Bible, which is that one's behaviour on earth will lead to the kingdom of heaven? If you can one retain the power of the narrative and the moral instructiveness unless it's linked to, as it were, performance and reward in the hereafter?
Well, I know. This is a great difficulty about the Bible, I think. Not the Old Testament, but the New Testament, which does have stuff about the afterlife. I don't know how integral that is taken literally. I think it can be taken as a metaphor, not so much for what happens to us after death, but for what lasts, what survives, what is beyond time and goes on, as it were, transcendentally. These traces, we get glimpses of it, but we don't know the whole story. Now, some people genuinely want to take those pictures as a promise that they will live forever. But I guess most people don't, actually. They think in terms of the continuity of the world, the endlessness of the world, and the even, you have to get by heads nowadays, around the fact that this particular world with human beings may not last forever.
I was particularly interested in what you wrote about what one might call sort of rhetorical strategies of people of faith, for example, bishops in the House of Lords, that they're not sort of tub-thumping evangelical. They will invoke Christian concepts like the sanctity of life, and then you say they will sort of quickly move on to the consequential of the argument. So it's, in a way, it's sort of it's almost covert. It's sort of advancing an argument by somewhat. Maybe stealthy is not the right meaning, but not in a very overtly Christian way.
Well, I'm terribly frightened of being overtly Christian. And this is part of the title, Dishonest to God, was picked on, because I think if they really believe that morality is derived from God and that the sanctity of life is a law that God laid down, then they should stick with it. But actually, it's a bit shifty, really, to shift the ground and not go back to that. And they're frightened to go back to that because they know that it won't appeal to people who don't believe in God. But in a way, it weakens our argument, not strengthens it, that they shift from one basis to another.
And I thought you were very robust and vigorous in tackling some of the slippery slope arguments that they got adduced, for example, in end-of-life issues and the categorisation of groups as the vulnerable and therefore the ascription to those groups of particular characteristics. I thought it was very refreshing the way you tackled that.
Well, I'm vulnerable. Sounds to me actually bottled with rage because I'm now in the category of the vulnerable, being 87, and everyone thinks I'm vulnerable. I don't feel particularly vulnerable, but I do think that the argument which is tremendously widely relied on, that introducing a way of helping people who want to die when they're terminally ill to die sooner rather than later, has nothing whatever to do with people who suffer from disabilities and don't want to die. I mean, they're two completely different subjects. And I think that to introduce this idea that this would put disabled people at risk is very, very deceiving.
How do you think the best way to sensitise the general public to arguments of this sort is? Do you think there has to be more philosophy in schools? In what way? Because you talk interestingly about a leading Catholic in the House of Lords who has his ideas changed by empirical evidence, by visiting Robert Winston's embryology clinic. And I thought, that's really a very good argument for education in its broadest sense. So with so many of these debates concerning quite sophisticated science, you know, deciding what a human life is and what value to ascribe to various phases, what is the best way to broaden the public's understanding of such things, do you think?
I do think that one of the best ways is at a very, very early age, when children are too small to take in general arguments, is to work by example and get them to be interested in what's good rather than bad, what's intolerable rather than tolerable, and what sort of behaviour is unacceptable. That way you introduce the concept of morality. By example, by not sparing all words if a child is behaving badly. And then they get the concept of behaving well rather than badly, and they begin to want to behave well. After that, I think communication discussion is a very, very good way. I used to be very hostile to teaching philosophy at school because I used to suffer terribly from people who'd done the French baccalaureate and said they'd done philosophy already when they came to be my pupils as undergraduates. But I've come round to something that isn't quite philosophy, but it's discussion. Because after all, people can get information from the internet with the help of their teachers, but what they can't get is communication. And I think at all levels, that's in school, is one of the most important things. And then after that, you need non-dogmatic, non-judgmental teachers who can present lots of different sides and arguments and get people to think. I do think that's a very important part of education. And actually, the subject that's taught in some schools is called critical thinking, and I think it's a very, very good subject.
Mary, I wanted to switch finally onto a very different subject, which is music, because you write about music in the book, and it's quite an interesting test case, in a way, for the way in which religious feeling influences many of our lives, even if we're not conventional believers. And you write about St. Matthew's Passion and your experience of that. Tell me what you think the questions about that raises in this context are.
I find it very difficult to articulate the question, but if we think of the imagination, the human imagination, opening up things that are sort of everlasting in the sense that there's always more to discover, more to find out, more to experience. And this, I think, is one of the most important things, if not the most important thing that education can do to expand the imagination, so that you're not bored or you don't get to the end of it all. I think music, to me anyway, is the medium through which I get more of a glimpse of what is literally unspeakable. I can't put what one experiences into words. Words are not adequate. And I think this is one of the things that religion can open up for some people. Really, it certainly does. Music and religious music does so for other people. And I think it is incredibly important that children should be exposed to all kinds of imaginative constructions, including religion, that may fire them off and make them think there's something more than the table and chair that I'm sitting at the moment. And that does seem to be very important, and the function of the imagination, and the religious imagination among others.
And what is the appropriate time for that something which is more than the table and the chair, that quality which we may encounter in St. Matthew's Passion? How do you refer to it?
I think some people talk about the transcendental. And I think that's not a bad term, but it means something more than what you actually see and hear, something behind it. Some people talk about the spiritual, I suppose. I'm never happy with that, because most people equate spiritualism, the spiritual, not spiritual, the spiritual with the religious. But I think if you allow the spiritual to include the aesthetic, the imaginative experience of any kind, whether you get it from nature or art or music, then I don't know what the best word, the transcendental or spiritual, will do for me.
I was talking to Mary Warnock. That's all for this podcast, but there's plenty more to explore on the festival website at ideasfestival.co.uk, including an audio archive of interviews and, of course, news of forthcoming festival events. Do join me again soon for another Festival of Ideas podcast, and until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.